A public inquiry into the murder of Belfast solicitor Pat Finucane began last week. He was shot dead in front of his family in 1989. For 37 years, his widow Geraldine and their children have campaigned for a full public inquiry into allegations of British state collusion. After all these years and campaigning, the hearing has begun. It's News Talk Daily. I'm Ciara Doherty. Pat Finucane was just 39 years of age when he was murdered in his home in Belfast on February the 12th, 1989. He was sitting down to a meal with his wife Geraldine and their children when gunmen entered the house and shot him dead. His family have always argued that this was not simply the act of a paramilitary group acting alone. They say agencies within the British state colluded in the killing, and over the years several examinations have found evidence of collusion. In 2012, the then British Prime Minister David Cameron apologised to the family. But the Finucanes have never accepted private reviews or limited investigations as enough, and they've campaigned tirelessly for a full public inquiry with the power to compel witnesses, examine evidence and establish who was involved, who knew what and whether the murder could have been prevented. Well, that inquiry began in Belfast last week, chaired by Sir Gary Hickenbottom. For the Finucane family that remain, they will hope to finally get the answers and the truth that they have sought all of these years. And Michael Finucane is the son of Pat Finucane, and he joins me on the line now. Michael, you are very welcome to News Talk Daily. What was it like for your family last week to see that inquiry finally begin?
It was something that brought a great sense of relief. And I think to some extent, a weight or some of the weight has been lifted because we've finally sat in an inquiry chamber watching and listening as a proper public independent judicial inquiry was commenced. There have been points in time in the past when an inquiry was contemplated and even arrangements put in place where if certain things happened, then an inquiry would be instituted by the British government. But those commitments have not been followed through. And it has, as you alluded to in your introduction, forced us to campaign and also to litigate against the British. So after what might be described as a great many false starts, we finally got up and running and we're finally within the matrix of an inquiry proper. I suspect that will go on for some time. The inquiry only sat for one day and has adjourned to do what will probably constitute the bulk of its work, which is gathering evidence and reviewing documents and materials that will ultimately be presented in public. But that exercise cannot commence properly until the inquiry has sat, and thankfully that has now happened.
For listeners, Michael, who might not know the full story, the full background, can you tell them who your father was and why his work, I suppose, made him such a significant figure all those years ago?
My dad was one of a family of eight growing up in West Belfast. He was born in 1947 and he attended grammar school because free secondary education became the norm across Britain and the north of Ireland in the late 50s. And then that expanded out into public funding for third level education. So he and a friend of his from the local area became two of the first people to attend university. And he studied for a general degree in Trinity College in Dublin. He started his college studies in 1968, just at the point in time when things were really exploding in the north. And I think because he wasn't immersed in the conflict that was brewing and would ultimately continue for so many years, I think he became somebody who sort of thought about things in a different way. But I think he always was somebody who was probably going to come back to Belfast and probably somebody who was always going to seek to do something connected with helping and serving his community. If things had turned out differently, he might have even gone into politics at some point. But as it turned out, he got an apprenticeship in a Belfast law firm served his time and qualified as a solicitor. This would bring you up to sort of the mid, round about the mid 1970s. And at that point, you had a situation that had developed where the British had prorogued the local government. So direct rule had been implemented from Westminster. And the British government started to take a more direct and militant approach to the civil conflict in the north. You know, they enacted emergency legislation that allowed for widespread arrests and detentions. There was, of course, internment for a while. So given the inception of these quite extreme legal powers, it was the perfect landscape for an enterprising and ambitious young lawyer to see how far they could go in terms of flexing their legal muscles. And my dad, as an individual, he was, I think, ambitious. He was motivated. He was clever and curious. And I think he saw a challenge and rose to it. He was also quite a competitive individual, as anybody who would tell you who ever shared a football pitch with him. He was an extremely good soccer player in his day, and he was aware of it. So I think all of his character traits became focused on his legal practice, and he really started sort of taking to the work with great relish.
But it was through that work, I suppose, that he became a prominent figure and ultimately became a target.
Yes. I mean, the things that he was doing weren't, you know, original or innovative in themselves. I mean, he didn't invent the concept of legal representation, but he did, I suppose, personify a new generation of lawyers who were prepared to take on work that was in direct opposition to what the state wanted to do in Northern Ireland, and that as a result was unpopular because the people he was defending were unpopular and sometimes accused of very, very serious offences. The amount of information that was permitted to be shared outside of Ireland about what was going on in the north was actually quite limited. So it was rare for a lawyer working at the coalface to start explaining what was happening and explaining the way legal norms were being manipulated and changed and how they were being used. And my dad was one of the few lawyers to do that. And I think he didn't shy away from the fact that it gave him a public profile. But sadly, it also brought him to the attention of people who sought to do him harm. And I think he became a kind of a bit of a poster boy for the anti-establishment section of the legal profession. Because at that time, because of the amount of paramilitary activity, any criticism of the state was just immediately cast as support for paramilitaries, which of course wasn't the case. But it was very much a sort of a, if you're not with us, you're against us type scenario. And my dad got quickly sort of shoved into the category of sympathizer, when in fact what he was doing was holding up the legal standards and the legal instruments that are being deployed against people in the north of Ireland and saying, look, these don't meet up to international standards. They are not lawful and they should not be used. And to the extent that his arguments were tested, he repeatedly prevailed in the superior courts and also the European Court of Human Rights when he was bringing his cases to those venues.
Which I suppose brings us to the family's call for this public inquiry, because the family, your mother in particular, but I know you and your siblings have felt that you never really found out, never clearly established why your dad was targeted, who wanted to see him dead, who was pulling the strings behind this ultimate operation to end his life.
I mean, that is the ultimate question that falls to be both addressed and hopefully answered by the public inquiry. What we knew at the time from the late 80s was that my father was being told by clients of his, people arrested and detained in RUC holding centres around Belfast and elsewhere, that the RUC detectives were openly threatening his life during interviews, interviews that were not video recorded. So therefore, the threats could go pretty much unchallenged, and certainly didn't bring with them any consequences for the officers who were making them. But there were too many instances of too many different people who didn't know each other coming to my dad and saying, look, they're saying they're going to have you shot. They're saying they're going to give your details to loyalists. They're telling me, get yourself another lawyer. Yours won't be around for very much longer, as well as multiple other disparaging remarks about my dad and sort of perceived sympathies on the political situation and so on. So and some of these things he noted down in his own handwriting, and the notes still exist today. So when he was killed, there was that to consider. There was also a public statement made by a junior Home Office minister in the House of Commons, and this occurred only a couple of months before the killing. A man called Douglas Hogg, who made a statement in Parliament where he claimed that a number of solicitors in Northern Ireland were unduly sympathetic to the IRA. And this information had been, it now seems clear, was fed to him by senior RUC officers who were extremely aggravated and annoyed at the way their actions were being challenged by a number of solicitors who practiced in the North. This was believed to be essentially a green light to loyalist paramilitaries, that they were free to attack a defence lawyer or even multiple defence lawyers under the cover of negative publicity being generated by the government in the House of Commons, which would serve as a smokescreen to sort of explain away the controversy that would arise from the killing of a practicing lawyer. And that is what happened. The murder took place in February 89. The reaction of officialdom at the time was almost a kind of a shrug of the shoulders. A claim was made by loyalists that my dad was in the IRA, and everybody within the establishment appeared to accept this, including the likes of the Law Society of Northern Ireland and the judicial system. They all believed that as soon as a paramilitary organization said, well, we shot somebody, but he was in the IRA, that this was accepted as fact, when in fact, you know, neither before nor since has any evidence ever been presented that my dad did anything that was even unethical, never mind illegal. And the chief investigating police officer of his inquest specifically refuted this and said that he was regarded as an energetic and vigorously professional man going about his duties in a professional manner. An unusual enough thing for a senior RUC officer to say at the time, but the superintendent, Alan Simpson, made a point of doing it at the inquest in 1990. But it didn't address all the stuff that was going on in the background. And since then, fairly convincing evidence has emerged, not only of a systemic campaign and a systemic policy of collusion between the RUC and loyalist paramilitaries, but also of a fairly extensive and well-established intelligence network by other agencies like British Army Intelligence and MI5.
So there has been those previous reviews, there has been findings of collusion. So what are the central question that you want this inquiry into your dad's murder to answer?
Well, there are a number of questions. First of all, why were no warnings ever given to him? Despite the fact that, based on what we know now, there were at least three clear instances when active threats were identified and even imminent attacks on my father, possibly in our family home, which would, of course, expose his wife and children to danger. And why was that information not passed on? What superseding consideration was preferred over the, one would think, fundamental obligation to protect and save life? If that's a policy, who put the policy in place? Was it overseen? How many different agencies were aware of all of these threats? To what extent did the threats extend? How many other deaths are we talking about? You can't talk about the case of Pat Finucane without looking at the system of collusion that existed in the North and how many, not only what agencies were involved, but how many of them were aware of particular paramilitary operations and plans at any given time.
How difficult is it for you, your siblings, your mother to go back through all of this again, even after fighting for the inquiry for nearly four decades?
Sometimes it feels very draining. Sometimes it's a really exhausting exercise, particularly after so long. You get buoyed up by apparent successes or progress, and then you kind of have to endure an awful lot of frustration as you think you've gotten to the point where, you know, the British government is going to have to concede something, and then they just, you know, pull the shutters down and sometimes just say no without explanation. So then you're forced down the route of litigation, as we've seen before. So I sometimes say to people, ironically, you know, if we thought that it was going to take 37 and a half years back when we started, you know, we might not have gotten going at all. But despite the sort of the often disappointments and the, you know, the sometimes feeling of fatigue, you also feel that you're involved in something important, and that it's important to a lot of people. And you feel that, you think that, and then, you know, people come over and they say, you know, I don't want to disturb or intrude, but I just want to say, you know, well done, and do continue with what you're doing. You know, you're really doing something very, very worthwhile and important here. After a while, or we got the sense after a while that, you know, this really is bigger than us. This is about everybody, because it potentially affected everybody. And when you know, there was nobody in the North who wasn't affected by the conflict to some degree. So you're doing something that's about the whole place and everybody within it, everybody who was directly affected by it, and everyone who had to just live through it as best they could.
It's much bigger than your own family, is what you're saying, and actually it's possibly about the wider peace and reconciliation process that Northern Ireland, I still think, is going through and has to go through looking into the future. I said 37 years. Were there times, Michael, over that three and a half decades that the family said, enough, we need to stop now, we need to stop this fight, we need to try and make peace with what's happened and move on with our lives?
No, I don't think we thought that, but certainly I think there were times when we had to support each other, that somebody was finding it, you know, some one of us might be finding it particularly difficult, so somebody else would come and would step in and say, look, you know, take some time, just step back and let somebody else carry the burden for a while. I mean, my mom in particular, she'll kill me for saying this, but, you know, when she wasn't even 40 when her husband was murdered, she's got three kids, and her life got turned upside down in the space of 90 seconds. She herself was shot in the ankle, so she had to physically recover as well as emotionally and mentally and everything else. And she kind of carried it for more or less on her own for a good many years, because we were all still growing up. Now we are grown up. I'm a solicitor. My brother John's a solicitor and the MP for North Belfast. And my sister Catherine is a psychological counsellor. We are now in a position to bring, you know, skills and abilities to the campaign, and have been for some time. That makes it that wee bit easier on somebody like my mother, so she doesn't have to do it all herself. And the rest of the family, my father's brothers and the extended family, they all play a part. I know it's a controversial issue. I know it creates difficulties for the British state, but, you know, you just got to bite the bullet. I mean, it doesn't serve anyone by just kicking the can down the road, because here we are nearly 40 years later. And the name of Pat Finucane is, if anything, more synonymous with what went on in Ireland, and not in a good way, than ever. So it teaches you that you just got to resolve it. And to that end, we've supported each other over all that time, because we know we just have to keep going.
Just very briefly, Michael, the inquiry, any inquiry like this, can last years. What are the biggest challenges that you think this inquiry is going to face?
Well, it could last years, although hopefully not too many years. It's difficult, painstaking work. And you're going back over, many, many years and many, many separate and different incidents. There's a lot to get through. So it probably will take a few years to finish. Challenges might come from resistance within the British state to providing all the information. But I suppose the difference now is they've got to justify that in a public forum. Previously, they could hide in offices and corridors of, you know, Westminster or Whitehall or wherever they hide, and they would never, ever be called to account. Well, now there is a judicial inquiry with full legal powers that can, and we're told, will call them to account. So that's the difference. It may not be a challenge faced by the inquiry. We may see, maybe for the first time, full transparency, but I'm going to retain a certain healthy level of skepticism on that score. But we have the best chance, I think, to really investigate this incident properly at long last. And, you know, I think all of us are looking forward to it. We're not dreading this. We're not going into it reluctantly. We're going into it with full enthusiasm for doing the best job we can. And every assurance we've had from the inquiry chairman and the panel members and everyone associated with the inquiry is that they're coming to it with the same attitude. So hopefully what we will get from the inquiry is full and frank disclosure, and we will get to the truth at last.
Michael, thanks so much for taking the time to speak to us here today, and we will be following the inquiry here on News Talk for as long as it lasts. Until tomorrow morning, from me, Ciara Doherty. Take care. Bye-bye.